Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Empty Promise Podcast. My name is Chris, and today you are joining me on episode 85, as I am joined by my best friend in the whole wide world, Mr. James D. Downey.
Hello, everybody.
One week we'll get this introduction thing right.
No.
Feeling every single week. Thank you for joining us on what is a Sunday morning. It is, current time is 11:16 a.m. We have strong headwind.
He's just thinking that?
Yeah. It is the 18th of August, 2019.
August? That French?
It is.
Is it French?
I don't know, actually. No, I don't think so. August.
Augustus.
Augustus.
Oh, what's his name?
Augustus.
I cannot think of it.
Is it like, isn't it, it's a glump? Or,
yeah,
like, Augustus.
Yeah, yeah. Augustus glute or something again. It's like gluttony or something, I think.
Yeah, the guy that falls into the chocolate in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Or Willy Wonka in the Chocolate Factory, actually. Not Charlie. That was
Augustus Gloop, I think it is.
Gloop, yeah.
Augustus Gloop.
Good shout. Well done. Our first one. Hello and welcome if you're new to the podcast. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for finding The Empty Promise. We hope that this podcast serves you well.
Yeah.
This is the podcast where me and my best friend get together every week to just catch up, basically.
It's a very difficult thing to pinpoint.
What do we even do?
What do we do?
I don't know. Yeah. We don't have a set, you know, there's no parameters within this within this podcast.
We give you a fun fact.
Mm-hmm.
We give you some news.
Yep.
Otherworldly and interesting.
Yep.
And we give you a topic.
We give you a topic that is completely decided at random.
Yeah. Completely varies from the most serious of matters to the absolute stupidest things. Yep.
And then we get personal with the podcast. Yeah. Is where you get to find out what we get up to every week. Oh, we do. We get quite intense. But if you're a regular listener, you already know that. So thank you for joining in once again. And you can find the video version if you're listening to the audio. There's a video version of this podcast and it's available over at youtube.com/XiteGaming. That's XITE gaming. Mm. That is the kind of umbrella that we operated under way back in the day. We haven't yet changed that name. Mm. I don't think we're going to. Maybe we will. I'd like to.
At this point, I don't even know how.
I don't. Yeah, exactly. We don't know what we're doing. And there are timestamps available below for this podcast.
Yes.
Both in the video and audio version. So you can just skip along to wherever you want to go.
Yeah.
If that makes it any easier for you.
Skip all of our nonsense. Mm-hmm. Which would be the entire podcast.
Yeah. Okay. Skip right to the end. As I said, D, it's the 18th of August, which means I do have an on this day factoid and list for you. In 1868, the French astronomer Pierre Jules César Janssen discovers helium.
Oh.
Though he does not know what it is.
But he knows it exists.
Yeah. Yeah.
The most abundant resource in the universe, Chris.
Is it?
Is helium. Yeah.
Right now?
Yeah.
What do you mean? Like it's just so readily available everywhere?
Yeah. It's like outside of like Earth.
Yeah.
It's like, I think it makes up like 70% of the universe.
No way.
Yeah. Because it's the most simplest form of like
matter.
Yeah.
Helium.
Hydrogen.
We can die in
it. My apologies, it's hydrogen.
Is it hydrogen?
I'm completely wrong. But helium is next. it's like so close.
It's so close.
It's hydrogen. God, absolute. Don't listen to me. Don't take anything I say as truth.
Well, I have some interesting facts about party balloons. Because, you know, you use helium in party balloons. Yeah. Party balloons come in two main types, those made of latex, rubber, and those made of mylar, or foil. Latex is not only biodegradable, it also breathes.
Latex is biodegradable?
Yeah.
That's interesting, because I would have thought it's the thing that's like...
That's not?
Yeah, like plastic.
Yeah, so it'll, yeah. No?
There you go.
It is best to store latex balloons away from heat and light to preserve their quality. Air-filled latex balloons can stay perky for days, if not weeks.
Perky.
A helium-filled foil balloon, however, can stay out in the air for a couple of weeks.
There you go.
That's interesting, yeah. The party trick of inhaling helium from balloons to make your voice squeaky can really be harmful and is not just boring old grown-ups saying so to try to spoil your fun. Yeah. There you go.
They use a mix of helium and oxygen whenever decompressing people from like deep sea dives.
That's right. They have to come back up into like little chambers. Yeah. Yeah.
And they sound funny for a period of time.
Otherwise, they go through the bends.
Oh yeah, the bends. That's right.
Yeah, and they get nitrogen bubbles in their brain.
Oh,
they die. That's a horrible way to go.
Fucking beautiful.
Yeah,
look at the knowledge being dispersed.
So much knowledge. This is it. If you're new to the podcast, this is what it is. It's useless knowledge, just about all.
If even knowledge, because I just got something major wrong there.
About helium.
About helium.
So. I like to believe that helium is the most.
Yeah. We just don't know it yet.
We just don't know it yet. No, we will when we all start speaking in squeaky voices. What else have I got? I mean, I have some news. We could do news now.
Yeah, I mean, sure.
Do you want to do news?
Let's run into it because I want to hear some interesting factoids about the world.
Okay, I got some random news this week, D. Let's start off with this. You know Cheryl Cole? Or Cheryl Tweedy or whatever the fuck she wants to be called.
That anymore,
no.
She
well, her waxworks has been removed from Madame Tussauds because she is no longer relevant.
Oh, damn.
I know.
Oh, what a serious. Doesn't that sting?
Yeah. So the former Girls Aloud singer Cheryl has had her waxwork removed from London's Madame Tussauds because bosses at the attraction reportedly believe she, quote, may no longer be relevant. The former singer, a former X Factor judge who now appears on the BBC talent show The Greatest Dancer, first appeared in 2010. Cheryl was one of Britain's most famous stars throughout the 2000s, but has seen her prominence wane in recent years.
That surprised me, actually. I thought she was one of those ones that was kind of like, she's still, I thought she was still like active.
Mm-hmm.
I guess not.
No. But a representative for the museum told the newspaper, the measure was not an uncommon thing to do with certain figures, as from time to time we do change who we have in the attraction.
That's it. I mean, you only got a limited space in there.
That's so. It. But I mean, there's obviously got to be ones that will like stay there probably forever.
I mean, like, yeah, I think, I'm pretty sure you can meet like JFK and like...
Yeah, the Pope.
Yeah, the Pope.
But like, would the Pope always change?
Yeah. The Pope's always changing. They change that out whenever there's a new Pope. Hardly.
The president? Like, is Obama always going to be there? Because, you know, he's Obama?
I mean,
or
yeah.
Or is Trump?
Big presidents probably get there. Yeah. Obama's like the first black president. He'd probably stay there. Yeah. JFK was like...
Was that in Nixon?
Probably not. I'd be surprised if he's in there.
Yeah.
Although he is
George Bush?
Big,
I mean, he's a pretty...
Yeah. I think George Bush would be one of the ones who would be eventually...
How did they decide?
He will eventually be rotated out.
Like, is there actors and... clearly actors and actresses, but then, you know, how does a... You know, like, The Rock, I'm sure he's going to be there for a while. But like, what about Will
for
Smith? I've barely heard of Will Smith in a while. I know he did like Aladdin recently.
Will Smith.
But you know, at a point there, he was huge, and then he just.
Have you ever looked at the list of the film roles that Will Smith has turned down?
No,
he has been up for like a serious amount of like. I think he was offered The Matrix. I think he was offered Neo.
Really?
Yeah, he turned it down. But to be fair to him, he didn't turn it down because he's like, no, I don't want to do shit like that. He was like, I don't think that's the right part for me. I don't think I'd be good as Neo.
So he kind of made that choice himself.
Yeah. He may have been right. You know, he made the creative decision. But like, apparently there's like, he has turned down some like...
Big roles. Big stellar
roles. Could have been.
But has someone else come along and then fulfilled those roles and made it like iconic? The way like Neo is iconic?
I'm not sure. That's the one I can remember off the top of my head.
Or has he turned down roles that have gone on to be just disastrous?
If I can get some internet, I'll look this up, Chris. I got no internet.
Right, speaking of which, what is your favorite Will Smith movie? Do you have one?
iRobot is the one that stands out in my head.
iRobot stands out in my head. I also like I Am Legend.
Oh, yes. Obviously a classic. Mm-hmm. I
find myself talking about I Am Legend a lot more than I really think.
Are they still making a sequel to it?
I
heard they were making
a
sequel.
Know.
I hope
they
do.
But I think anytime I ever talk about a zombie apocalypse, it's always like, which zombies are we talking about? Are we talking about slow zombies? Are we talking about I Am Legend zombies?
They got their whole like own category.
Yeah, they're their own thing.
Have you ever seen World War
Z?
Zombies?
Yeah, they're
those zombies are
they're crazy zombies. Yeah. That's Brad Pitt, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of Brad Pitt, have you seen Once Upon a Time yet? No. No. Okay.
I have not. No, okay. But I am very eager to see it. I was trying to convince Laura to see it the other night, but she was like, it's like 3 hours now.
It is, yeah. I was tempted to go yesterday to the matinee. Yeah. I was going to say manatee, but that's a sea creature.
The sea cow, Chris.
The sea cow.
The manatee.
I was going to go yesterday to it, but then I didn't.
Fair.
True.
Good call.
But Will Smith, yeah, there you go. He may be in Madame Tussauds. I don't know who else would... David Beckham's bound to always be there.
Yeah, I think they probably give English celebrities prominence. The Queen.
The Queen.
Will always be there.
The Queen will always be there. Will Kim Jong-un be there?
No.
No.
Probably not.
Probably...
You get a lot of flack for putting a thing of him in, I'd say.
Would you?
Yeah, I'd say so.
Do they have Madame Tussauds in North Korea?
I doubt very much so.
South Korea, maybe?
Very much so, I doubt that, Chris.
Ah, I can't... Let me see.
Do you know who owns Madame Tussauds and like all of the sister companies?
Who?
Lego.
No way.
Yeah. Because I forget who it was, like the owner of like Thorpe Park.
Do they always pop up beside each other then?
No.
No. Okay.
It recently just happened that like the people who run Legoland and Thorpe Park, can't say that, also run Madame Tussauds.
Wow.
And Lego's bought them out. They're like, we got this.
I like when big companies buy other big companies out.
I just want one big company to own them
just
all.
Just one company to rule them all. I actually have a bit of news.
Or Disney.
This is a perfect segue. Inside the world's wealthiest family who earn a whopping 57,000 sterling every minute. Who do you think they are? Or where do you think they kind of,
what's their business?
Mm-hmm. I'm not asking for the family name, but you know, think about it.
Do they run a bargain store chain?
Yes.
It's either Pound Stretcher or Pound Land?
No.
Oh, okay.
Keep going. Go much bigger than that. No, sorry. I said 57,000 sterling, but this would be dollars if we were talking.
Oh, it's Walmart.
It's Walmart.
The Walgreens?
The Walton family. The descendants of the founder of Walmart live a lavish lifestyle, but have managed to avoid the spotlight for decades. The strange thing about the Waltons is although they are the richest family in the world, they have largely flown under the radar for decades. The clan are the descendants of Sam Walton, the founder of Walmart, and are worth a combined wealth of about $191 billion.
That's incredible.
Yeah, crazy. Absolutely crazy.
Do you know that Asda is the Walmart?
Yes, I was just good because about buying big companies, they own that. Asda. They also own... It owns the Asda supermarket chain in this country, as well as the Seiyu Group in Japan and the Best Price in India. So I'm assuming in Japan and India, those are like the big...
Those are big ones as well.
Yeah. In the last year, the family have earned 57,000 every minute, 3.3 million every hour, and 82 million per day. Since I began reading this, the Waltons' empire has expanded by 19,000.
That's mad.
Isn't that crazy?
Oh my God.
So there you go.
Imagine just making that money like second by second.
One of the sons is actually married to... Do you know the film Baywatch? The recent movie Baywatch?
No.
Never mind then.
Who is it?
The blondie girl. They're like main like Baywatcher. Yeah.
Is it that
she,
one?
She is married to...
Is it that one who was in True Detective? That's the only one I know
no.
from Baywatch.
No, not her.
No problem.
That's right. She's in True Detective.
Yeah.
I've been reading a lot of True Detective stuff this week.
Oh, have you?
Yeah, I have, yeah. You know, time is a flat circle and all that. Joe Rogan, how much money does he make per episode of a podcast?
I never actually thought of it that way before.
So one company dug in and it has been revealed that Joe Rogan makes $75,000 per episode.
Per podcast.
Of his podcast.
75,000, holy shit.
Yeah. To put that into perspective, they found that the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the median personal income was 44,000 per year. So Joe Rogan makes in 1.5 episodes of his podcast what most Americans make a year.
That's incredible. No wonder he does three or four a day.
This is the kicker. All of those figures are now a couple of years old. And considering that podcasting keeps growing, that 75,000 is now probably way up.
Does that count for like all his sponsorships and other shit he does that he gets from that?
He's done 1,332 to date podcast episodes.
Oh, it's a machine.
It's crazy. Absolutely crazy.
Although when you're making that money, why wouldn't you?
The recent one with Bernie Sanders is apparently doing like, what is like one of the highest.
I still have to listen to that. I've heard it's very good.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely want to give that
and
one a
listen.
And
he's been, as we discussed in the last podcast, he's been tipped for a moderator for the US presidential elections. So what a man.
What a guy.
Yeah.
Big Joe, we call him.
Got two other pieces
in the
news.
In the podcasting circle, we call him Big Joe.
I don't really want to talk about that bit of news. It's kind of shitty news.
BJ sometimes.
Yeah, BJ.
Depending how close you are.
Did you hear about Conor McGregor punching an elderly man in the pub?
Because he didn't take a drink off his whiskey. Of his whiskey. Yeah, I've seen the video of it.
Yeah, did you see the video?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's ridiculous, isn't it?
He's such a little bitch.
Yeah, 100%. But apparently the man who got punched by Conor McGregor, the UFC fighter, the champion, the world champion.
He's not anymore.
No.
He lost his belts because he didn't fight.
That's right.
Hasn't fought in UFC in like two and a half years or something like that.
He's kind of been out of the limelight for a while until he does stupid shit like this.
Yeah.
He had a pub in Dublin. He ordered a bottle of his own whiskey.
Yeah.
He poured three shots, one for him and two other gentlemen. And one, this Dublin boozer told the fighter, quote, "I don't want to drink that S-H-I-T." So then he threw a punch at him.
Yeah, yeah. It's actually, it's even worse than that, because he's like standing there, you know, doing the standard kind of, you know, arms out by his side, like, oh.
Up in your face.
Kind and kind of just like giving off them. You can't hear nothing, but you can just see this. Yeah. And as soon as the dude turns away, that's when he hits him.
Yeah, so it's just like, yeah, no call for that. Like, yeah,
but I think everyone, pretty much everyone in Ireland, is over Conor McGregor.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Over. Yeah.
Everyone used to love him. Used to be the absolute darling.
Yep.
Of Irish sport.
Yep.
And now it's just like, he's such a dick.
Yeah. Oh, big time.
Because he used to back it up by going out and winning fights.
Yeah.
But now he just like,
yeah, he could walk the walk and talk the talk. Then, yeah, absolutely. And now he's just punching old men in bars.
Yeah. Apparently he's mad for, like, I don't want to, is it slander if I say bad things about him?
No, I don't think so, no.
Cocaine, apparently.
Oh yeah, just mad. I could imagine so.
It's,
yeah,
crazy though, like.
Oh yeah, I mean, yeah,
he just lost all of his
good cred.
Yeah, his good cred.
I don't know if he ever had good
his
cred,
goodwill,
but he had a lot of publicity.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
He used to come out of fights after having won them and being like, you know, yeah, I talk a lot of smack, but this is what it's all for. And you kind of respect him for that. But now he comes out of, like, pubs after hitting old men. What's he doing?
I don't follow UFC, so I don't really know. But
I mean, he hasn't fought in like 2.5 years. That's why he's lost his belts, because he hasn't fought. He hasn't contested them. So he's lost them. And now it's like, people don't know when he's going to come back. And they're expecting like a big, oh, McGregor's back thing. But now it's got to the point where I think a lot of people will be like, who cares?
Who cares? This is the guy who was coming out and winning fights in 10 seconds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
And now he's doing this shit. Didn't he throw something through a bus?
Yeah, he threw like a shopping cart.
Yeah.
Through a bus of one of his competitors. And he broke a window and apparently injured a bunch of people.
That's crazy.
And at the time it was like, oh, is he going to get banned from UFC or what's going to happen? No, he didn't get nothing. They used
on the wrist.
They used the fucking video of it as a promotional video in his next fight. It's like,
that's insane. And then he fought Floyd Mayweather, didn't he?
Yeah.
Got like $100 million for that fight.
Jesus. That's all he's in for now. He's just cash. Money. I'd say he's just going to cash out.
Cash it, yeah. That's crazy, yeah. But yeah, that happened during the week. He punched some old guy in a pub.
Proper 12.
That's all like the interesting news I kind of have. Cause from we've last talked, it's only been a couple of days, really.
Has it? Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
We kind of, yeah. Besides, the news is just, it's just depressing now these days. All you know, all you're hearing about is fucking Trump and Afghanistan and Iran
and people. Yeah, we said that last week, that we don't want to really touch on too heavy a news in the podcast, because it.
Oh, here's actually a kind of positive
brings
thing.
You down.
There was a plane. This is just from memory. Don't have an article on this. There was a plane that hit birds on takeoff in Russia.
Right.
And like straight away lost power in both engines, but they managed to land it in a field like just about a mile away from the airport.
Wow.
The runway, and with no casualties.
Zero casualties.
Yeah. So, did pretty good.
That's insane. I seen a thing during the week. I'm not sure if it was because it was the anniversary, but the Concorde that blew up, that just went engulfed in flames when it took off from Paris that time.
That's right.
Literally just got up in the air, and then one of the engines just... One of the 109 on board, just dead.
Insane.
Just crazy.
When we're on the topic of air disaster.
Flight.
That was in that event in Russia. It'd be called like the miracle at the name of the place, which I don't remember.
St. Petersburg.
No. It's a fairly remote part of Russia.
St. Petersburg is Russia. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like the only Russian
place.
The
name is inspired by the miracle on the Hudson. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
I was actually going to talk about that. I was going to do that as my fantastic feat
on
today's
podcast,
but I didn't. I used a different air disaster instead.
Oh.
So we'll get there when that comes up.
The Miracle in the Hudson, I think there was a lot of complaints about that movie, about how he was betrayed, Captain Sully.
Yeah, I watched it
was
recently.
Betrayed.
Yeah. Yeah. Was I talking to you about
no.
it recently? Oh, well,
no.
Yeah. Pretty much it was like, in the movie, it's like a lot of it's focusing on the investigation after the crash.
Of course, yeah.
And it's like, it just portrays the investigators out to be like, out to get him, if you know what I mean? Yeah. They're like, you could have landed this plane at an airport and you messed up and blah, blah, blah. And then like, they do the big... what would you call that? A trial?
Yeah.
A simulation. They do a big simulation, get other pilots to do it. And whenever they do it live in front of everybody, he gets vindicated and it's like, oh, you couldn't have done it. You saved their lives, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
It was a bit Hollywood, I suppose. But the actual story about it is really interesting. But Sully Sullenberger.
I can't believe he landed the plane on the Hudson River. That's
the most successful air ditching or water ditching ever.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. What makes it successful? Just the amount of people saved?
The fact, yeah, the amount of people saved. Because typically whenever a plane lands in the water...
Yeah, they stand very little.
No.
Yeah.
Just
very little chance.
Breaks apart. But anyway.
Yeah.
We're not talking about depressing news.
No,
but
we're
good
not.
News.
Yeah.
Here's a funny one, Chris. I thought this was... I'll read you the article and you can make your own opinions on this.
Okay.
Woman thought she had kidney stones, gives birth to triplets.
Jesus Christ.
Right? Yeah. A South Dakota woman. So she didn't find out about her pregnancy until she went to the hospital when she thought she had kidney stones. Danette, as in like the female version of Dan, I'm guessing. Danette Giltz.
Yeah.
Of Sturgis gave birth to the healthy triplets on August 10th. She says that despite having two other children, she didn't know she was 34 weeks pregnant.
Jesus.
And when she started having pain, she thought it was kidney stones, which she has had before. Doctors told her she was actually in labor with multiple babies. The triplets were born within 4 minutes, each weighed about 4 pounds.
Four? Jesus, they're very small babies.
Is that very small? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't know.
I'm not good with babies.
I think, yeah. No, big babies, I think, are about like... 8.
What's 34 weeks as well? 34 weeks.
34 weeks is... So, what is a trimester? A trimester is like...
It's three fours, right? It's 3 months.
So, they go through nine months. So, 9 months split into three. Is three. So, in 3 months, how many weeks is there in a month?
Four.
Four at 12.
So, it should be 36 weeks total.
Yeah.
So 34 weeks. It's pretty close to
2 weeks,
term.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. I don't know.
That's such a roundabout way to work that out.
Sorry for all the math involved. The baby's names are... I just think this is fucking hilarious. Blaze. Gypsy. And Nikki. Who names her child Gypsy?
I know.
I mean, I assume that's Gypsy. G-Y-P-S-Y.
Yeah.
Maybe it's Jype.
No, it's Gypsy.
Gypsy.
It's Gypsy.
Gypsy.
I mean, a woman called Danette.
Danette. I didn't know she was pregnant with triplets. I don't know, America.
That's crazy, America.
South Dakota.
I did not know, though. I suppose that is quite small, but still you would know.
Three? How is that quite small? I'm guessing this woman is fairly large.
Mm.
That she didn't know she had 12 pounds of baby inside of her.
True, yeah. Because on a small kind of petite framed lady,
yeah,
you would definitely
super
see.
Super noticeable.
Yeah, yeah. She thought it was kidney stones.
Kidney stones.
Could it be anything else? Kidney stones.
Tarmac worker and plane passenger play rock, paper, scissors through the window of a plane.
That's brilliant. Where was this?
This Heathrow? Was in... this is America. Yeah, I'm pretty sure. New Jersey? Atlantic City, New Jersey.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was... the guy on the plane won.
Well done. What did he win? Just rock, paper, scissors. Okay. Was there a video of this?
There was a video of this.
Oh, good.
It's good if you watch the video of this.
Good,
if we were doing our show notes, we would link a video in there. We don't do those yet.
We could do it. Yeah, we're working on show notes.
We're going to start doing that soon.
Yeah. We'll have some notes for this podcast.
Here's the kind of good news Bible news one, Chris. 65-year-old man hailed a hero for tackling far-right mosque gunman to the ground.
Was this in Australia?
It was in Norway.
Okay, because I heard... Okay, yeah, you go with this one first.
Basically, yeah, 65-year-old man tackled a gunman who stormed a mosque in Norway. He's being hailed as a hero. Witnesses said Mohammed Rafiq restrained the terror suspect and held him down with another worshipper before police arrived, despite being injured in the struggle. Mr. Rakif was among three people at the Al Nur Islamic Center in Byram on Sunday.
Jesus.
In Saturday. That's a typo in the thing. When a man burst in with two shotgun-like weapons and a pistol.
Jesus.
Shotgun-like
weapons?
Shotgun-like. Maybe they were like sawn-offs or something. The attacker, who reportedly was wearing a uniform and body armor, broke through a glass door to reach the place of worship where people were preparing to celebrate the Islamic festival of Eid al-Adha.
Okay.
Eid al-Adha, I'm not sure what that is. Speaking to press outside a nearby hotel on Sunday, Mr. Rafiq said, "I am thankful for all of the help and support I have received." He told how he held down the gunman while another worshipper, Muhammad Iqbal, hit him in the head. Ifran Mushtaq, board member of the mosque, said that minutes before the shooting on Saturday afternoon, around 50 people had been inside the building.
Jesus.
So while he had a low period, there were people around.
That's crazy.
The same man is also accused of killing a woman whose body was found at his home.
Jesus.
So, I mean, on one hand,
fair play to that guy. Yeah. There was something very similar in Australia, where two Brits actually came to the rescue of a knife wielding terror attack guy. Stabbed two people, I think, on a rampage, and they tackled him to the ground with a knife and managed to keep him pinned until the authorities got there.
It's a serious thing to do, isn't it?
I mean, you'd like to say that, yeah, if you've seen someone attacking someone with a knife, you'd do something, but that's a scary situation. Like, it's a knife. All it takes is one wrong move.
I've seen it. I once watched a video on YouTube which highlighted, like, what you see in the films, yeah, TV shows about people wielding knives, and they come at you with a knife and they go to stab you, and like, you can like block them and kick the knife away. It's like, in reality, like, what people do when they have knives isn't like telegraph it's an slash. Attack. It's like bang, 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 and it's quick and it's rapid and it's very difficult to stop. And it's just a scary thing to go up, risk it. You are essentially risking your life.
You're risking your life, yeah.
You know, your instinct is telling you to run, to fight or flight. So to choose fight, it takes a heavy set pair of balls, Chris.
It does. It does. That's a good thing, though.
Oh, yeah. There's people out there who want to do this. In 2011, a white supremacist, Anders Behring Breivik, massacred 77 people in Norway. That was, remember that?
Oh, yes. The guy who was on the islands?
In the islands.
Oh,
yeah.
Shit, yeah.
At a youth camp. But yeah.
That's insane, actually. Yeah.
But this was a good case. This time was prevented. There's been a serious amount of these happening recently, though.
What, the terror attacks?
These, like, yeah. Like,
there's like lone gunmen just walking in. Yeah, I know. It's fucking insane. Crazy. I'm actually, I'll talk about it after. I don't want to talk about it.
So I'm going to finish on something light and positive, guys.
Okay.
A stranger drove a National Guard sergeant 8 hours so that he could make it home for his son's birth.
That's brilliant. So, a stranger?
Stranger. Again, this is America, but it's positive news this time, guys.
America.
National Guard sergeant credits a stranger for helping him make it to his son's birth after his flight from Philadelphia to West Virginia was cancelled due to bad weather. Seth Craven, 26, had flown to Philadelphia from Afghanistan on August 5th in preparation for his wife Julie's scheduled cesarean section on August 9th in Charleston, West Virginia. He intended to catch a connecting flight to West Virginia on August 7th, but his flight was cancelled, so he rescheduled his trip so he would fly out the following day, August 8th, but that flight was cancelled too. Jeez. So he said, all car rental places were sold out due to the storm, leaving him completely stranded. And just when he thought he was out of luck, Craven was approached by Charlene Vickers, a programs director for AmeriHealth, who was at the airport and offered to help. Vickers and her colleagues were headed to Charleston for an event on Friday, and she had an extra seat in her car.
That's so nice. It's so good to hear that.
It's just amazing. Like,
I like that. I like these little things, yeah.
But like, what happens if two flights in a row get cancelled?
I know.
That's insane.
Imagine. Why?
And he must have obviously pinned all his hopes on getting the flight because he had a day. I mean, sure, he could have got a bus or some form of navigation home, but it was like, no, I'm going to take the flight, and it got cancelled again.
Hear that Norwegian Air has pulled all its flights now from direct flights from Ireland to the US.
Yeah, I heard about that. Yeah,
Jesus, that's crazy because they were such a big company and a very cheap.
Were they
a cheap airline? Yeah, and now they've just pulled everything. Apparently, it's to do with like they're not sure if they can not replenish, but reschedule that same plane to go again for another bout of flying. Whatever it is. Right, like, it's coming in for, let's say, a plane MOT. And it's not, they're not sure whether it's going to be, whether their planes are going to be ready to go again. Yeah.
I prefer them to do that than to send a plane back that's not ready.
That's not ready. Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, before we get stuck into our main topic of this week, remember that you can find this podcast and all our previous podcasts over on any podcast hosting service. Just search for Empty Promise Podcast, and you will find all of the previous podcasts there. And if you want to find the video versions of them, you just go to youtube.com/XIGaming, click on the podcast section. There's a couple of, we have videos on the channel as well, but all of our podcasts are found there. And remember, timestamps and some show notes will be available in the description and links below.
Chris, don't make me commit to the show notes then.
Okay.
I said it in passing. Crap.
Our main topic this week, we are delving back into a previous series that we started quite a while ago.
Mm.
Actually, what was your first
incredible feat?
Yeah, I think I remember it. There was the guy who survived on the island.
Was
who hid from Spanish settlers?
Oh, maybe it was, yeah.
Conquistadors or something?
No.
No.
Was it that? I don't know. They had to do Apollo 13. for one of mine.
Oh, that's what it was. It was Apollo 13.
Apollo 13, it was, yeah. Yours was Touching the Void.
Touching the Void. Touching the cloth. Yes, so we are delving back into the Fantastic Human Feats and Where to Find Them yeah. series, where we look at just amazing human endeavors or accomplishments or life-changing experiences from humans at some point over the course of humanity, and we will be talking about those today. So,
got a couple of good ones for you.
Saddle up. How do you want to do it? Do you want to go first?
Strap in.
I go first. It's up to you.
I'm
really excited to hear yours.
I don't mind, actually. Although, whatever you think.
I'm happy. Can I go first?
Yeah, you go first.
I want to get mine kind of over because I want to settle in for yours.
I like yours. Yours is like a... Because yours has like quite a bit of media coverage
already. Yeah, okay.
A lot of people want to hear more about this.
So my fantastic human feat this week comes from a guy called Aaron Ralston. And if you haven't heard of Aaron Ralston, you may better know him as James Franco in the movie 127 Hours. Great movie directed by Danny Boyle. He is the guy who, spoiler alert, but he gets caught in a very tough predicament while out in Utah back in like 2000s, where he got his arm pinned against a canyon wall, basically. Mm. And his survival over the next 4 to 5 days basically became one of the biggest and greatest stories of human survival and what the human mind and body is willing to do to survive, basically. So Dee, the way I've said I'm going to do this is, or the reason I took this one up is because I've recently read his book, which I should have probably brought out for the table today. I didn't, but I recently read the book, Between a Rock and a Hard Place, which is a great title for a
fantastic
book.
Fantastic.
Unbelievable. By Aaron Ralston, but I've brought up the kind of shortened version here on my phone. So we'll kind of go through that and then I will add to it what I see fit to kind of bulk out the story from my knowledge from the book. Okay.
You're an Aaron Ralston expert, Chris.
No. Yes. Yes. Okay. So let me see. So Aaron Ralston was a mechanical engineer back in 2003. He worked in Denver and he had a serious passion for rock climbing and the outdoors, mountain biking, things like that. Mm. He was very skilled in skiing, rock climbing, canyoneering, things like that. He had a very strong knowledge of the sports in general.
Sounds like a bit of not an adrenaline junkie, but kind of like that.
Kind of like that. Yeah, definitely.
Didn't have a death wish, but he definitely liked all that.
He studied mechanical engineering and a couple other things at college before moving to the Southwest to work as an engineer. Before he quit his job 5 years in and decided he wanted to remove himself basically from like corporate living, if you like, and just move and work and devote more time to mountaineering. So I think he got like a little job at like a... what I gather is like a store that like rents out like climbing equipment, things like that. Okay. And he also wanted to climb Denali, which is the highest peak in North America. In 2002, Ralston climbed the 14ers, which are the 14,000 feet high mountains in Denver, in Colorado. He wanted to climb all of them, all 59 of them, and he wanted to do them solo. And he wanted to do it in the winter.
Why?
Which is, as you say, it's like an adrenaline junkie kind of thing, because no one had done it before.
Oh,
no one had
yes.
attempted it before. So he seen it as a challenge that he wanted to do. And he did.
He did all?
He did. He did all of them. He did. He climbed the whole lot.
59 peaks.
Mm-hmm. All 14,000 feet peaks. Climbed the whole lot solo in winter, basically. It's crazy. Like, absolutely crazy. In February 2003... while backcountry skiing with a couple of friends, Ralston was caught in an avalanche, buried up to his neck in snow. A friend of his dug him out, and together they dug out the third friend, which he describes in his book as he basically persuaded them to ski into this what was known as a bowl. And they kind of all knew from the look of the snow that there was a high avalanche risk. Now, after the whole avalanche thing and they dug them out, he says that he never heard from the two friends again. He said that was it. The friendship kind of just ended at that point.
he convinced him to go into an avalanche.
Yeah, no one was seriously hurt. But they should have checked for the avalanche before obviously skiing into the bowl. While most climbers might have then taken steps to be more careful, Ralston did the opposite. He kept climbing and exploring hazardous terrain completely solo. Now, something he did, and he said he's always done before he went on any kind of expedition or journey or whatever, was he always left a very kind of detailed list of where he was going, how long he planned to be, how long each day he would, you know, be there, a map just to leave back at home.
So he did go missing.
Family, friends, things like that. Yeah. So they'd know exactly where he wanted to go. Then a couple of months after the avalanche, on April 25th, 2003, Aaron Ralston traveled to southeastern Utah to explore the Canyonlands National Park. So this park is like, I don't know, hundreds of miles big. And I don't know if anybody's familiar with Utah or what it kind of looks like, but it's very like red, barren,
it's like
stone,
Grand Canyon type country.
Sandstone, kind of smooth walls. Basically, a climbers and hikers paradise. There's a load of like little like natural river, like glacier rivers, I think, that like make these lovely like big blue lagoon pools and stuff. Cool. You know, you swim in and things like that. So Ralston journeyed up. He parked his truck at the entrance to the park. He parked right in front of the sign, which you're not supposed to do. And he said he did that just because he was sleeping in the back of his truck that night. He said he did that just because the ground was uneven and he wanted his truck to be flat.
Oh, okay.
Now this comes into play later on in the story, but he parked right in front of the sign. So he took off into the canyon. He set off, first of all, on his mountain bike to cover. His plan was to cover so many miles on his mountain bike. But shortly into his journey, he came across two other hikers, two female hikers called, I think, Melanie and Christy, I think were their names. He caught up with them. They all then got on really well. He was explaining what he was doing and the girls explained where they were going. And he says, you know, they all kind of merged as one kind of big group working their way through these like cliffs, if you like. All having a great time. The girls then suggested a party that they were going to that night. It's very common for all like these like in the climbing community for like these big kind of parties that take place.
Yeah, yeah.
And everybody gets together and they talk about their experiences and things. That's what I gather from his book anyway. That this was a common thing. And he knew then that his other friends, two other friends, one was called Brad and someone else, I think his wife, were due to meet him as well at this party. Although he had just said that he may be at this party, that he didn't give a definitive whether he would be there or not. I should note as well that this was the only trip that he's ever made that he did not leave behind any details as to where he was going. Or
sounds about right, Chris.
Sounds about right. So he takes off. The girls part ways. They take off.
The girls take off. They're heading for the party? Or
they're heading off. Yeah, they're heading off back to the trail, to the car park, to get back into their vehicle. He's going off on his own. He wants to see more of this canyon, these climbs and stuff that he wants to do. He rides his bicycle a further 15 miles to Blue John Canyon, which is an 11-mile long gorge. In some places, it's just 3 feet wide. So Jesus. It's like this big, I don't know if you can picture
it. It's like a crack in the ground.
A big crack in the ground, basically. That's exactly what it is. And it's actually like 100 feet below the actual ground level. There's a picture. I can show you that picture.
That's insane. Yeah.
Of what it looks like.
That's incredible. But you know what it reminds me of? I don't know if this will give it for anybody. Mm. Who wants an image of it. Do you remember in Indiana Jones?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
What
yeah.
is it the third film's called?
The Last Crusade.
The Last Crusade.
The Last Crusade.
Like navigating through this like canyon. Yeah.
Yep.
There's just this very narrow path and these mad cliff walls on either side.
Yeah. That's exactly what it's like. So he takes off on his own and he's making his way through this canyon, which, as I've already said, is only like 3 feet wide in some places. And he gets to a point, he's describing like some of the climbs he has to do through. So there's these, it's an area very well known for flash floods. So a flood will happen further up in the canyon and basically the water will literally rip through these canyons. And with it, it takes all like this dead wood and these giant boulders. And some of them get wedged in the rocks. So he's having to climb through all these rocks to get to make his way through the canyon. And there are signs of like previous canyoneers who have been there, who have put like the little pegs into the walls and things for climbing. But around 2:45, he went to climb over this giant boulder that was there. this 800-pound boulder. This thing is absolutely mammoth. And while he was climbing over it, he was beginning to make the descent down. The rock slipped, and as he fell, so he's climbing over a boulder, he's climbing down it, the rock slips, so he's facing the boulder. It slips, it first of all pins his left arm to the canyon wall, but quickly reverts back to the other side, and the way it describes in this book is it crushes his right arm and pins it to the wall from the hand up halfway to the forearm, basically. And then skids down the wall, dragging his arm down the wall, where he is then trapped. So he is an 800-pound boulder now pushed against his right arm, keeping it in place in the wall. He can't move. He is touching the floor now. He's stood on the bottom of this canyon. And that's it. He's stuck there. He thinks, initially he said his thoughts were it wasn't sore. There was no real pain out of it. The biggest pain came from the scrapes just on his legs from where he had fallen. And there was a bit of pain in his left hand. But within the first 30 minutes or so, he had noticed that the blood had completely cut off in his arm. He had no kind of tingling in the right hand. There was no feeling, no nothing. And the adrenaline obviously was just flowing through his body. So he didn't really know what to make of the whole situation. With him, he still had some of his supplies from earlier on that day. So he had a backpack. In his backpack, he had a digital camera. He had a Walkman, which he always brought with him, a CD player at the time, which is, it's weird because anybody listening now that isn't familiar with that, this is what people used to do. You take a CD and a CD player and you had headphones.
He had a little bag with all his CD discs.
So he had that with him. He had two burritos that he made up, a couple of candy bars, a couple of chocolate bars, and he had the hydration packs.
Oh yeah.
On his back, he had one of those that was filled, and he has a basically like my water bottle now. It contained, I think, 900 mil of water. Okay, so he had that with him, and the first thing he did was took inventory as to what he had or what he could do to help get himself out of this predicament that he was in.
He's found himself in.
First thing he realized was he was thirsty, and without thinking, he began drinking his water. And he said he drank three or four giant mouthfuls before it clicked in his head. He was like, hang on, I need to stop. He goes, I'm pinned here. And then the sudden realization hit him that I could be here for a while. And he says immediately in his head, he said he knew a couple of things. He was either going to die here, someone was going to find him, or he'd have to amputate his own arm to get out.
Jesus Christ.
That was the initial thought.
Straight up away.
He was like, there's no way that this boulder is, I'm going to be able to move this boulder. So that was the three things. I'm either going to die, someone's going to find me, but I'm in the middle of nowhere, or to get out, I'm going to have to amputate my own arm. So he began to take inventory, and the Camelback, that's the make of the hydration pack that he had, actually developed a leak in it during the fall. Water on his back began leaking. Like, there was no way he could save it, basically. So he drank as much of that water out of his hydration pack as he could to completely top him up, and he filled up his 900 ml bottle, and that was it then. That was all the water he had left. So that pack was useless, rendered useless at this point, no good. So he had also had a pen knife with him. This pen knife, he said, is something that you would get like from your local hardware store whenever you buy something for like $15 and they give you one free. Yeah. That's like the caliber. Because he said you never need it, but he took it with him this time on the off chance. Don't know why. It was just something he had. Yeah.
Fuck me.
He also had a load of ropes and little clips and things that like climbers use. I don't know what they're called.
Yeah.
But you know what I'm talking about. Yeah. So he thought maybe if he fashioned like a big kind of rig, he could rig up the boulder. He knew from being an engineer how much pounds of pressure he would have to put on to possibly move the boulder a little bit to free his arm. So he did this. Being caught the way he was, it was like it took him ages to kind of ring it up. He only had one hand. He used his left hand, so he had to tie all the knots and go through all the little like, I don't know what you call them, like the wee hooks. To rig up this system of pulleys that he lodged into like cracks in the wall to hopefully give himself a bit more leverage to move this boulder off his arm. But he realized that the ropes were just too springy, if you like, and they weren't applying. There wasn't enough pressure on the rope. So his next idea was, he had the penknife. He opened up the penknife. There was two different blades on it. There was one large blade, one small blade, and then a pair of pliers. And there was also a saw blade on it. He took the larger blade and he began to chip away at the stone around the arm. He thought, if I can chip away enough room, I might be able to free my arm enough to get out. So he began chipping away. This wasn't doing anything, but he said, if nothing else, it kept his mind busy. It kept off, you know,
the bad thoughts that could creep in.
Eventually he started to get a bit tired of standing. His legs started to hurt after a while, so he fashions like a harness kind of rig that enabled him to take the pressure off his legs. He could kind of lean back on. His arm still stuck, of course. And that, he said he'd be able to spend maybe 10-15 minutes in this harness before it would get too tight, and then he'd have to stand again for a further 10-15 minutes and keep repeating that process over and over again. So he was stuck in a really bad predicament here, D. His hand was crushed. He had his burritos to eat. He wasn't worried about food. He wasn't hungry. He wasn't too thirsty. He was just panicky about the whole kind of, but he knew he had to remain calm. Let me think, what happened between that? So the first night came around and he said the temperatures dropped to like ridiculous, like just so cold in the canyon. He was so used to the heat all day that these temperatures just got so cold. So he actually had to use the ropes. He just wrapped the ropes around his leg, as not as tightly as they could, but as tightly packed together as they could, as it was the only form of insulation. So at the time, he was only wearing a pair of shorts, a pair of like cycle shorts, and then a t-shirt and his baseball cap. So he insulated using rope, basically.
That's insane.
He also cut open then his Camelback hydration pack for a bit more insulation, and he pulled it on over his head like a hood. And he thought that breathing against the inside of that would create like the condensation, or, you know, just his breath basically would heat him up.
Warm.
First night, he said, passed him by. Not too much difficulty. So second day, he again begins to chip away at the stone, realizes that he's not getting anywhere. This stone is like rock solid. He is not getting anywhere with this. So he decides to try then chipping away at the canyon instead, the actual wall that he's stuck against, for the same thing, that if he can create a bit of room, he might be able to take his arm out.
Yeah.
No good. He realizes how futile his efforts basically have been, and this kind of doubt starts to creep in as to whether or not, you know, how long he actually might be here. The way he worked it out in his head, he worked it out that if he could chip off a piece the size of his thumbnail, so the first bit of rock that he uncovered from the actual stone was about the size of his thumbnail. It took him like 2 or 3 hours to do that, so he started working out how much rock he could get rid of and how long it would take him. Basically, it was going to take him like 2 days of solidly chipping away to have enough room to maybe take his arm out. He realized this was a silly kind of idea. And then he realized something, that even if, I'm getting ahead of myself. So he's stuck, it's day two. He decides that he has his water, but he has to ration out his water basically. So he works out that he can take a sip every 2 to 3 hours, one sip.
Jesus.
And then this becomes very kind of mentally draining. Knowing that, he said it was a good thing in a way, because he was always counting down the time to when he could have some water, and he'd always look forward to that. He ate his chocolate bar or whatever, and the burritos then started to go down over the next couple of days. But he said without any water, it was just like paste in his mouth, and it was very, very hard to take down. He worked away at his water, and I think eventually then on the third day, so this guy's been stuck here 3 days now at this point, 3 very cold nights, the exact same thing. He's not getting anywhere with his arm. He runs out of water. Basically, there's a very small amount of water left, and he's thinking maybe if it rains, but then if it rains, a flash flood could come.
Yeah, drown.
He would drown. So he thinks, what if I drink my own urine? So he pees into his cup, basically. And totally. He said he was never really put off by the idea of drinking his urine. It's just more so the thought. So he let it sit, and after a while, the sediment, if you like, kind of it filtered into two different layers. His urine was at the top, and then all like the crap from his urine was sitting at the bottom. He drank it naturally to try to keep himself, you know, hydrated in any way he could. But eventually it started stripping away at the inside of his mouth because his urine was so, like, I don't know, acidic or whatever is in it. You know, it's waste product at the end of the day.
God almighty.
Every morning at eight o'clock, as the sun would rise, it would bring like this ray of sun into the canyon. And that was his one kind of joy every morning. The sun would hit him. He would begin to warm up again. He started creating like little, as we know them now, like vlogs on his digital camera. Basically depicting his situation, what to do in the worst case scenario. But he never really wanted to think that he would never get out.
Mm-hmm.
But he was becoming very kind of hallucinogenic, if that's
a word. Starting to see things.
Yeah. Very disorientated. Headaches started to creep in. Basically, he kind of knew that his time was coming where he had to make a big decision as to what he was going to do. So he thought, first of all, he started experimenting with the idea of having to cut off his own arm. How was he going to do it? How was he going to free himself? So he knew, first of all, he'd have to create some kind of a tourniquet.
Yeah.
So we call it
to stop the blood.
To stop the blood. So wrapping a couple of things, cables around his arm and tighten them. He took his knife. And he placed it against his forearm. The way he describes it is he places the knife against his forearm and he makes, he tries to cut.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, even with him putting all the pressure and slicing along, he says, all it's doing is creating a line in his arm. It's not even breaking the skin. That's how dull this
knife is.
Yeah. So without thinking, he literally draws the knife up and just plunges it into his forearm. Just straight in, just a knife, just straight God in. Almighty. He said it makes like a 2 to 3 inch deep pit in his arm, which is about 2 inches wide as well.
God.
He said there was absolutely no pain out of it. He said he pulled it back out and he was expecting this like pool of blood. He says, but it was like a very deep, deep red and a very slow.
Oh yeah.
Because there was no blood going to the arm.
The arm was dead at this point.
Yeah. A little tiny little bit of blood just ran out of his arm. So he kind of used his finger to open the wound a little bit to kind of feel around and see what was. He said there was no pain out of it. But then the realization hit him that if he wanted to get through his forearm, he'd have to get through bone.
Yeah.
Oh. And he looked at his pocket knife and he realized this isn't happening. So the idea of cutting through his own arm on like day 2 or 3, I think that was, just became something that wasn't going to happen. So he went back to chipping away at the wall. He thought, this is it. This is how I have to get out of here. At this point, he's realizing now that if he is, after three days, so this was on a Friday, so he stuck Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday he was due back into work. Okay, so he realized that if he didn't show at work, but he worked out in his head that even if he didn't show for work and even if nobody knew where he was and they went to his house, they would have to wait at least 24 hours again before filing a missing persons report. So it would be Tuesday at the earliest before people even begin to file a report, which means it would be Wednesday at the earliest before they start looking for him. Even if they start looking in the right direction, it could be Wednesday night, Thursday morning before they even get close to where he is. He says he didn't have the water, he didn't have the food, he didn't have the mental capability to survive to Thursday morning. Every morning as well, at the exact same time, he said it was about 8:10, 8:15, a single hawk would just fly overhead, just straight down the canyon. And he said it was just like an out-of-body kind of experience of seeing this hawk fly. Don't know what it was, just something that happened that he remembers from his experience. So at one point...
Is there rain?
At one point... So he's drinking his own urine. He's got no water left. He's wrapping himself up in ropes to keep himself warm at night. Let me see, where am I going? I don't know what way I want to go with this. Back home, his family then have realized that he's gone missing. They realize that he's not there. Not at work, his mum's beginning to worry. A couple of his friends are like, don't worry about it. You know, Aaron's like this. He can sometimes go away for days and not come back. We're used to him disappearing.
Yeah.
But he always does leave a kind of schedule of where he's going or how to contact him. But something seems off about this and they file the missing persons report. So back home, authorities are starting to go through kind of where he was last seen, finding his vehicle registration and tracing it, things like that. So the hunt is on for him at this point. This is day four.
Search party has begun.
Yeah, the search party has begun. This is day four. He is basically down and out. The boulder's not moving. It's not going anywhere. He is getting fed up. He's got no water. He's got no food. He's surrendered himself basically to dying. He's created his last kind of epitaph. Is that what you call it? Basically a video will where he passes on everything to his family. He thanks them all for his years.
That's crazy.
For everything, his friends, his loved ones. He says that this is going to be it. He carves in RIP Aaron Ralston, and then April 29th on the wall, because that was what he presumed was going to be his last day. And basically he gave up. He sat there and that was it. He was kind of just, he said at this point he was just waiting. Either people were going to find him or he was going to die. Fair. And that was it.
That's crazy.
During this time when he was kind of in and out of sleep, he had this vision of a little boy playing, and the boy was happy and his family was happy. And he didn't know what it all meant. And then suddenly he said, envisioning this boy, he knew it was, he knew he had to get to him. He didn't know what it was, he didn't know what it meant. And he had this epiphany that he could get through his arm, but he had to break the bones. If he broke the bones in his forearm, they would break in such a way that it would allow him an angle through the bone and his knife could go just straight through basically.
Oh.
Arm, flesh, muscle, nerve,
the whole thing,
artery, whatever. But the bone
is out of the equation. Then,
being a mechanical engineer, he realized that the best way for him to, so he's pinned with his right hand against the wall, the best way to break his arm in such a way, he had to go under the boulder basically until his arm snapped one way. But it wasn't enough. He had to come back the other way to snap it the other way, so that it would be a clean break straight through, so that his now forearm bone would be in two pieces, basically, just whatever way. He broke it the first way, and he kind of put pressure on his arm. He could see the bone sticking out through his skin. He said there was no real pain out of it.
That's insane.
And then he went the other way, and it snapped, and there was no pain out of it.
Imagine hearing your own bone.
Exactly. I can't even imagine what that is like. And then he knew he didn't have long, because it was going to, this whole like adrenaline surge of breaking his own. He said he knew he had to start cutting through his own arm. He knew he didn't have long, because as soon as he started, eventually it was going to ebb off and his body would become very conscious, very aware of what he was doing. And he would either pass out through blood loss, through pain, through whatever. So he cut into his arm, and he said the way he did it was he cut around the skin first of all, into the next layer, which was muscle and tissue, which was tough to get through. But he kept feeling around with his fingers and finding like the little capillaries and veins, and pulling them out with his finger one of the times that they were on the surface, and then slicing them one of the times to make sure the blood loss wasn't anything. He found an artery, and he knew he couldn't cut the artery. That had to be the last thing he cut. So he found the artery and he went round it.
Jesus Christ.
Imagine
having like the
mental.
Yeah, like the awareness that, okay, I have to cut.
Yeah.
Like, it sounds like such an alien thing. I have to cut this capillary, this vein, this vein. Yep. I'll keep that artery for last.
This guy is cutting his own arm.
He having said, the objectiveness the object- to do it to that do way. That. God, mate.
He says there were three nerves running through his arm. He said three basically like wire thin nerves running through his arm, and he says even the slightest touch with his finger just sent this shockwave right from the tip of his fingers that he knew were dead right through his elbow up through the right hand side of his body. He said the pain was crazy. So he used the pliers of his tool. Yeah, he used the pliers of his tool to break each of the nerves in his arm, which I can't even, there's no, we'll never be able to fathom just what that's like.
I
can picture it.
I can feel like a drilling going through my body. Yeah, just exactly.
The three nerves were then shot to shit. And the last thing attached to his arm was literally, so in one, so you have this rock and pinned to it is an arm coming out, and then it's severed, and then there's a little artery, and then there's the arm attached to him, the stump, and he had to cut the artery. And he did. And there wasn't any blood. He said there was no blood. He said there was hardly anything, nothing whatsoever. He used his the supplies that he had, the camelback things that he had laid aside that he knew was going to have to make a bandage to cover the stump. Yeah. He wrapped it up. He kept the tourniquet on. He basically fell, and he knew once he fell, he didn't have long. The first thing he had to do was find water.
Because even without he needed water.
But he knew it was about between 11 and 15 miles back to where his bike was. So he then had to get there and then get from his bike to his car and then from his car to rescue, basically. Yeah. So he had a long way to go. And with all the climbs and descents that he had to do, he would have to be doing them one-handed with all his equipment, with a stump that he's just cut off.
Without having had water for days.
Yeah. So the one of the last things he did was he took pictures of his hand still in behind the rock, took pictures of his arm, took pictures of his surroundings on his digital camera, packed everything up to go, and then headed through the canyon, one-armed, with whatever he had left. He came to a giant drop, and at the foot of the drop, he could see a small pool of stagnant water. It said it took him ages to rig up a line, and during that time, he was kind of passing it out, but he knew if he passed out, he would probably fall clean over the edge, and that would be him. He managed to keep consciousness, rig up a line, abseil to the bottom, where he found water. It was stagnant, it was putrid, but he drank it. He drank loads of it. He filled up, then he filled up his water bottle, and he began making the hike back out of Blue John Canyon. And halfway out, there was a German family, a mother, a father, and their son walking through the canyon, and he just cried for help. Cried for help as much as possible. They seen him, they discovered him, they ran over to him. He explained the situation and told them that they need to run and find help. At this time, the search party were in the canyon looking for him.
They were looking for him?
But they were nowhere near. Like, the helicopter's out, but they couldn't find.
Is that because he had, like, went off his own route?
Yeah.
He went with those girls at the start?
He went off the route with the girls at the start, but then he found his way back onto this, like...
It's like a trail for people to follow?
Yeah.
And he went off that?
He went off that.
Okay, I see.
He met up with the family, who obviously gave him fresh water, and he said that all they had to eat were Oreos, but he said that they tasted like the best Oreos in the world. To wrap up the story then, basically they got him medical help. They got him onto a plane. They got him onto a helicopter, left him to the hospital. They went back and recovered his arm. Obviously, it could never be reattached because it was gone.
Just as a memento.
As a memento. But then he went through a series of operations, skin grafts, the whole lot, mental rehabilitation, the whole lot for the experience that he had. Spent weeks in hospital, weeks back home. And now he lives a life to the full. He still rock climbs, he still skis, he still abseils, does the whole lot. But he is... definitely my fantastic feat for this week. Yeah.
That's incredible.
It's like my telling of the story doesn't do it anywhere near as much justice as the book does, or as
the film
as well is a pretty good description of what happens
between a rock and a hard place.
Between a rock and a hard place. Yeah.
I think whenever the film came out, 127 hours, a lot of people were brought this story of a guy who got his arm trapped and cut it off, and they were like, that's crazy.
Yeah.
But whenever you hear the whole story, like, I mean, because naturally you're not going to do something as dire as that unless you absolutely 100% have to. So whenever you hear the whole story and it all sort of...
So for 5 days he was stuck. He had no water, he was running out of food, he had nothing, and the entire amputation took about 1 hour.
That's insane.
1 hour of cutting through your own arm with a dull penknife is just something else.
But the thing that I didn't know, though, is that he didn't feel the pain.
No.
Which makes it, I mean, it doesn't make it much better.
Yeah.
But at least he wasn't in pure agony throughout the process.
He said whatever pain did come, it was like a euphoric thing because he knew that the pain meant he was getting closer to being free.
True, yeah.
So he kind of kept registering any pain he did feel with that, like...
I suppose it's better than feeling nothing at all.
Exactly,
because it's like your arm. But that is, it just shows the absolute pure will.
Yeah, that's it. It's a sheer determination.
I mean, I suppose after 4 days of, being trapped, maybe I'd consider it.
Yeah, would you
objectively, like, sitting here in this chair talking about this, would you do that, Chris?
No.
You cut off your own arm?
I couldn't even picture it. Like, I couldn't even picture for stuck in a canyon like that.
That is the power of human determination.
Yeah, going through those cold, long nights, which he said dragged on for so long because... you know, you were just counting down the hours till you could get another sip of water.
Yeah, uh-huh. You know, that's the only thing keeping you
in
going.
The freezing cold.
Absolutely crazy.
Crazy. 5 days.
And yeah. Had a rainstorm come in, he could have been flooded out.
He could have been drowned. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that was always in his head too. And then it's absolutely insanely crazy, crazy human being.
Just yeah, that's incredible.
I will link the book in the description of this video, and I would also link the film and the little video clips that he actually made that you can watch them on YouTube.
That's insane.
His like documenting, if you like, with his camera.
I will definitely check that
the
out.
Things he was saying. So they will be linked in the description of this video if you want to see that. But I highly recommend for any readers, read the book. If not the audiobook, you can listen to it. It's fantastic. So
that's tremendous.
There we go.
A fantastic human being, yeah. Indeed, Mr. Aaron.
Aaron Ralston. So, Dee, I'm now looking forward to hearing your fantastic feed of the week. I want to sit back and enjoy this one. I feel like I've done enough talking. apologies for the video. I see that we've gone a little bit dark.
Well, it got deep.
It did
right?
get
we
deep.
Got, yeah. We got some dark topics
that
we want to talk about.
Big rain falling outside as well.
That is some heavy rain, Chris.
That's big fat rain. Yeah. That will soak you, that
big fat frog, Chris.
My goodness.
We had a gorgeous morning and now we have this.
Yeah.
That's Ireland for you guys.
Well, I'm going to sit back and I'm going to enjoy because I have no idea what you're about to fill my brain with, but I'm looking forward to it.
Mine's pretty incredible, but it's not like it doesn't require the sheer level of will that Aaron Rolston obviously
has. That's fine. It's still a fantastic.
Mine is just it's almost a crazy feat out of circumstance, out of just pure luck, maybe than anything else, but incredible nonetheless. I'm going to be talking about Lanza Flight 508.
Lanza
is it's a Peruvian or South American company. I'm not sure if it's just based in Peru or all of South America.
Okay.
Líneas Aéreas Nacionales Sociedad Anónima.
Okay.
Lanza.
Okay.
So they're actually out of, they're no longer operating.
Yeah, okay.
This was one of their last flights.
Okay.
But on the morning of December 24th.
Ooh, Christmas Eve.
In 1971, Lanza Flight 508 departed Lima, Peru. The plane carrying 92 souls across the Amazon rainforest encountered an area of severe thunderstorms when traveling approximately 6.4 kilometers above sea level.
Right. Jesus.
The pilots, who were allegedly concerned about missing the holiday schedule because it was Christmas Eve, decided to continue the flight.
Okay.
Shortly after, inevitably, disaster struck. In what will later be termed as the worst lightning strike disaster in history, a lightning thunderbolt strikes the craft midair, causing critical damage. The plane disintegrates 2 miles above the ground.
Shit.
And it plummets. After 10 days, an intensive search for the missing plane was abandoned. But miraculously, 2 days later, the sole survivor was found.
No way.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Juliana Kupka. Kupka.
The sole survivor. Oh, I just got goosebumps.
There were 92 souls aboard the plane. 91 of them perished.
Jesus.
There was one survivor.
10 days after.
12 days after.
12 days after. So what? A lightning struck this plane.
Yep.
Over the Amazon, and the plane just completely disintegrated and plummeted down to.
It more or less exploded. What I have here now, Chris, is actually testament from Juliana Kupka herself.
Brilliant.
Along with a couple of little factoids about the event and her story.
Yeah.
So. Kupka, the lone survivor of Lanza Flight 508, survived a 10,000 foot fall from the sky and survived 11 days alone in the Amazon rainforest. She grew up in Lima, Peru, grew up her whole life. Before, at the age of 14, she moved into the Peruvian rainforest. So she moved from like Lima, Peru, deep into the Peruvian rainforest, where her parents, Maria and Hans Wilhelm Kupka, so they're a German descent.
Right.
They established the Panguana Ecological Research Station. So they had like a vested interest in the middle of the rainforest where she lived for 2 years and accompanied them into all sorts of research trips into the jungle and adventures and became quite familiar with the jungle before she was, I think she was made return to Lima for like a proper education.
Yeah.
Sort of to finish off her high school education. So on December 24th, 1971, Juliana, who was 17,
Jesus.
And her mother boarded the flight in Lima, bound for Pucallpa.
Okay.
Pucallpa. Pucallpa. Pulkapa.
Okay.
Apologies. Which is the city closest to Panguana, where her father and mother were living. She was going back to visit them for Christmas.
So her mother boarded the plane with her?
Her mother went back to Lima to take her back to the thing. So she didn't travel alone. So now, what we have now is an article written by Juliana.
For her own words.
This is written for the Reader's Digest. She tells us, my mother prefers to fly to Pulkapa. I'm sorry, I can't remember. Earlier, but she had a school dance and my high school graduation ceremony were on December 22nd and 23rd, respectively. So I begged my mother to let me attend. She says, all right, we'll fly on the 24th. So circumstances dictated that she went on this very late flight to try and get home. Jeez. When they do get to the airport, it's packed. When we arrive the morning of Christmas Eve, several flights have been cancelled the day before and hundreds of people now crowd the ticket counters. Around 11 a.m., we gather for boarding. My mother and I sit in the second to last row on a 3-seat bench. I'm by the window, as always. My mother sits beside me and a heavy set man sits in the aisle seat. Mother doesn't like flying. She's an ornithologist and says it's unnatural that a bird made of metal takes off into the air. So fair kind enough. Of old fashioned in that way.
Yeah, yeah.
The first half hour of the flight is uneventful. We're served a sandwich and a drink for breakfast. 10 minutes later, as the flight attendants begin to clean up, we fly into a huge thunderstorm.
Jesus.
Suddenly, daylight turns to night and lightning flashes from all directions. People gasp as the plane shakes violently. Bags, wrapped gifts, and clothing fall from the overhead lockers. Sandwich trays soar through the air and half-finished drinks spill onto passengers' heads. People scream, people cry. Hopefully this goes all right, my mother says to me. Next thing I know, we're falling fast. People's shouts and the roar of the turbines suddenly go silent. My mother is no longer at my side. I'm no longer in the plane. And I'm still strapped into my seat on the bench at an altitude of about 10,000 feet. I'm alone and I'm falling.
Jesus Christ.
Just like that, it changed in an instant.
Just literally went from, obviously the lightning hit the plane and she, oh my God. And that's,
instead of a roaring engine, it's just silence just and silent. Falling
She's
through
just
the
free
air.
Falling through, still strapped into her seat.
Strapped into her seat.
Fucking hell.
They later say that the fact she was strapped into her seat is probably what saved her.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
My free fall is quiet. I see nothing around me. The seatbelt squeezes my belly so tight that I can't breathe. Before I feel fear, I lose consciousness. When I come to, I'm upside down, still falling, the Peruvian rainforest spinning slowly toward me. The densely packed treetops remind me of broccoli. I see everything as if through a fog before I pass out again.
Oh my God.
So Kopka, still strapped into her seat, survived the fall to earth with a broken collarbone, a gash in her right arm, and her right eye swollen shut. So she fell 10,000 feet,
upside down, strapped into a seat, and she gets a broken collarbone.
Just insane.
My God.
Some of the theories about why she survived is because she was strapped into a seat with two
adjacent
seats.
It was
the full bench, so it kind of like acted as like a drag as she was falling.
So what did the mother just
wasn't
just never seen again? Just it wasn't wearing a seatbelt.
I'll get to more information about her mother. She lands into the canopy, and again, that probably like sort
yeah,
of
it breaks
cushioned
the fall.
It
yeah,
a bit,
yeah.
But it's pretty much miraculous that she fell and survived.
And didn't impale herself on a branch or
exactly.
something?
Exactly.
Jesus.
When I regain consciousness, I've landed in the middle of the jungle. My seatbelt is unfastened, so I must have woken up at some point. I've crawled deeper into the sheltering back of the... I've crawled deeper into the sheltering back of the 3-seat bench that I was fastened to when I fell.
Mm-hmm.
Wet and muddy. I lie there for the rest of the day and night, so kind of just exhausted from the entire experience. I will never forget the image I see when I open my eyes the next morning. The crowns of the giant trees above me are suffused with golden light, bathing everything in a green glow. I feel abandoned, helpless, and utterly alone. My mother's seat beside me is empty.
Christ.
So, let also remind you, this girl's 17
years old.
17
years old.
You know, she's going back to see her dad for Christmas.
Oh, fucking hell.
I can't stand up. I hear the soft ticking of my watch, but I can't read the time. I can't see straight. My left eye is swollen shut. I can only see through a narrow slit in my right eye. My glasses have disappeared, but I finally managed to read the time. It's 9 a.m. After a while, I manage to rise to my knees, but I feel so dizzy that I immediately lie back down. I try again, and eventually, I'm able to hold myself upright. I touch my right collarbone. It's broken. I find a deep dash on my left calf, which looks as if it has been cut by a rough metal edge. Strangely, it's not bleeding. So, jeez. Not sure what happened there. I get down on all fours and crawl around, searching for my mother. I call her name, but only the voices of the jungle answer me. Luckily, I'd lived in the jungle long enough as a child to be acquainted with the bugs and other creatures that scurry, rustle, whistle, and snarl. There was almost nothing my parents hadn't taught me about the jungle. I only had to find this knowledge in my concussion-fogged head.
That's so crazy.
She's familiar with the jungle.
Isn't it crazy though that like the sole survivor is someone who is conditioned with the jungle?
Well, this is it. You know.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I guess people from like Peru and stuff probably would be.
Would be well out. Oh yeah, of course.
About it in general, but like, yeah, she actually lived deep in the jungle. With like her mum and dad. Suddenly, I'm seized by an intense thirst. Thick drops of water sparkle on the leaves around me, and I lick them up. I walk in small circles around my seat, aware of how quickly you can lose your orientation in the jungle. Mm-hmm. I memorize the location and markings of one tree to keep my bearings. So, like, she has.
Yeah, she knows about like travel orientation.
I find no trace of the crash, no wreckage, no people, but I do discover a bag of candy and eat a piece. This would be the only food she finds for the duration of her ordeal.
Jesus Christ.
I hear the hum of airplane engines above. I look up, but the trees are too dense. There's no way I can make myself noticeable here. A feeling of powerlessness overcomes me. I hear the dripping, tinkling gurgle of water that I hadn't noticed before. Nearby, I find a spring, feeding a tiny rivulet. This fills me with hope. Not only have I found water to drink, but I'm convinced that this little stream will lead the way to my rescue. So one thing that her dad had told her mm-hmm. when she was quite young is that humanity or like human settlements always based around water. Yeah. So if you ever get lost, you can follow water
yeah.
and that will lead you to people.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like the one thing that sticks with her because the rest of her ordeal,
yeah.
she just follows the river. Jesus. She sticks to it.
It's a smart move.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, she was sensible about it. She starts to follow the river down. And her watch breaks on December 28th. Mm-hmm. So she tries to keep track of the days now mm-hmm. as she goes. Since it's rainy season, there's barely any fruit to pick. And I've sucked on my last candy. I don't have a knife to use to hack palm hearts out of the stems of the palm trees, nor can I catch fish or cook roots. I don't dare eat anything else. Much of what grows in the jungle is poisonous, so I keep my hands off what I don't recognize. But I do drink a great deal of water from the stream. Finally, I'm standing on the bank of a large river, but there's not a soul in sight. I hear planes in the distance, but as time passes, the noise fades. I believe that they've given up, having rescued all the other passengers except me. But I don't give up. Where there is a river, people cannot be far away.
No.
The riverbank is much too densely overgrown for me to carry on hiking along it. I know stingrays rest in the riverbanks, so I walk carefully. Progress is so slow that I decide to swim in the middle of the river instead. So,
Jesus Christ.
It's too overgrown to walk alongside it. She can't walk in the shallow parts of it because of stingrays. So she decides to swim. I didn't
even know stingrays lived in like the Amazon.
In the river as well. I thought they were like sea.
Sea, yeah.
But yeah, she decides to swim down the middle of the river. Stingrays won't venture into the deep water. I have to look out for piranhas. But I've learned that fish are dangerous only in standing water. I also expect to encounter caimans? Yeah.
Alligators?
Alligator-like reptiles. But they generally don't attack people. Like... I couldn't even. If I knew that either piranhas or...
Or you wouldn't even set foot in the river.
Nowhere near it.
Oh my God.
But she goes down and swims right down the middle of it.
This shows just the knowledge this girl has.
Well more equipped than I am, I'll tell you. Each night when the sun sets, I search for a reasonably safe spot on the bank where I can try to sleep. Mosquitoes and small flies called midges buzz around my head and try to crawl into my ears and nose. Even worse are the nights when it rains. Ice cold drops pelt me, soaking my thin summer dress, which is the only
Bit of clothing
she had. The wind makes me shiver to the core. On those bleak nights, as I cower under a tree or a bush, I feel utterly abandoned. Just the worst conditions. Yeah, like
that's horrible.
One morning, I feel a sharp pain in my upper back. When I touch it, my hand comes away bloody. The sun has burnt my skin as I swim. I will learn later that I have second degree burns.
Oh, so from swimming?
From the sun on her back. Jesus, as she swims. Christ. Just,
this girl's going through a fucking ordeal.
Often I'm convinced I see the roof of a house on the riverbank or hear chickens clucking. She doesn't. I fantasize about food. From elaborate feasts to simple meals, each morning it gets harder to stand up and get into the cold water. Is there any sense in going on? Yes, I tell myself, I have to keep going. I spend the 10th day drifting in the water. I'm constantly bumping into logs, and it requires a great deal of strength to climb over them and not break any bones in these collisions. In the evening, I find a gravel bank that looks like a good place to sleep. I doze off for a few minutes. So basically, she's just drifting in the water. She's just...
Jeez.
She's just sort of at the point where she's not actively pushing anywhere.
She's just letting it carry her down the river.
Carry her down.
Hoping that she comes across civilization.
So I doze off for a few minutes. When I wake up, I see something that doesn't belong here. A boat. I rub my eyes, look three times, and it's still there. A boat. So she swims over to it. I swim over to it. I touch it. Only then I really believe it. I notice a beaten trail leading up to the bank from the river. I'm sure I'll find people there. But I'm so weak, it takes me hours to make it up the hill. She said also in a different interview, when she found the boat, she said, I didn't want to take the boat because I didn't want to steal it. So she like kind of
still have some kind of ethics.
Yeah, it's like I think it would have been forgiven in that circumstance. Oh, but it's probably a good thing she didn't steal the boat or take the boat. She works her way up this path, even though it takes her hours to get to the top of the hill. When I get to the top, I see a small shelter, but no people. A path leads from the shack into a forest. I'm certain that the owner of the boat will emerge at any moment, but no one comes. It gets dark, and I spend the night there. The next morning, I wake up, and still no one has shown up. It begins to rain.
Where'd the boat come from?
I crawl into the shelter and wrap a tarp around my shoulder. The rain stops in the afternoon, but I no longer have the strength to struggle to my feet. I tell myself that I'll rest at the hut one more day, and then I'll keep moving. At twilight, that night, I hear voices. I'm imagining them, I think, but the voices get closer. When three men come out of the forest and see me, they stop in shock. She calls out, I'm a girl who was in the Lancer crash. She says in Spanish, my name is Juliana.
Jesus Christ.
Forestry workers discovered Juliana Kupka on January 3rd, 1972. She'd survived 11 days in the rainforest alone. They delivered her to safety. 91 people, including Juliana's mother, died in the crash of Lancer Flight 508. Juliana was the sole survivor.
That is crazy.
The three men took her to a local village, and the next day a pilot volunteered to fly her to a hospital in Pucallpa. The day after that, her father found her in the hospital, and overcome with emotions, their reunion was a moment without words.
My God, that's crazy. Holy
shit. So she survived 11 days
in the jungle. In solo at 17 years of age after a plane crash. Fuck.
She had some candies that she found, little other food. She had a supply of fresh water and she just traveled.
What year was this?
1971.
Jesus, not that long ago.
Not that long ago. This woman is still alive today.
Wow.
She got married, lived a full life after this.
Is there any kind of extra reading you can do on this? Or has it ever been a movie? Or?
There's a movie about it. And there's also a really good documentary. That documentary is actually on YouTube. You can go watch it there. It's like an hour long. The documentary is called, Wings of Miracle or something. Just look up Juliana Kupka.
Okay.
Or
that will be in the description of this video.
Lancer Flight 508. Fascinating stuff.
That's crazy.
We later found out that there were 11 more survivors from the plane. From the plane crash.
Yeah.
That were who had survived the actual
The initial crash.
Yeah, but didn't survive in the jungle.
What happened to them? Just
died of starvation or exposure. Her mother was one of those 11.
No way.
Yeah. So her mother actually survived the fall. But didn't survive much longer in the Amazon.
How?
There's so little I could find out about that.
You know what I mean? Because her and her father, Her mother and her father like have lived in the jungle with her.
Mm-hmm. It could have been like she could have been badly injured when she
fell.
Yeah. I think.
Jesus.
Yeah, no, it's just it's crazy.
That's insane. That's a tremendous feat. That is a feat like to behold. Imagine surviving 12 days on the Amazon River by yourself. Second degree burns in your back, a broken collarbone,
after having fallen
from a plane,
10,000 feet,
no supplies, no food, barely any water.
It's insane, like.
Oh my god, I'd love to read up more on this. This would be.
Yeah, I mean, the articles I found.
The Lancet fight.
Lancet LANSA 508. The Wikipedia page and stuff on it is all quite sparse. Like, there's not like really in depth. You had to go looking for a couple of places to find all that information. But
what a feat!
Yeah,
as you say, I probably been in that situation, and it's easy for us to say now, like, but I don't think I ever would have got into the Amazon and willingly swam down it.
No. Not a chance in hell. I tell you what, as well, I don't think I might have found the river, mm-hmm. but I definitely would have got lost.
Yeah,
for sure. Yeah. I mean, she talks about how easy it is to get like lose your bearings. I think I would have lost it immediately.
Jesus. That's crazy. That's absolutely crazy.
She had the benefit
crazy.
Of having grown up in the forest.
Yeah. It stood to her.
It did indeed.
It saved her life is what it did. Jesus. What a story to tell, dude. It's incredible.
There you go. That's two people who survived against the odds.
Against all odds. Yeah. Fantastic. Fantastic human feats and where to find them. Part two. You've heard it here. And the references and any kind of links that we can provide from both of these feats will be available in the description of the podcast and of the video on YouTube. We will do some show notes at some point.
At some point, yeah.
Remember, you can find this podcast and all the previous podcasts over at youtube.com/XIGaming, or you can find the audio version on any podcast hosting service. Mm-hmm. D, I think all that is left after that like harrowing experience is to talk a little personally about what we get up to in the last couple of days.
Get personal with the podcast.
Let's get personal with the podcast. I have done very little. I had interviews to do at work during the week, so I had a day full of interviews.
You interviewing people?
I was interviewing. I became the interviewer.
Did it go to your head?
What's your experience of interviews like?
Not great, to be honest. I haven't done a whole pile of them.
Yeah, I was trying to think of this myself. Like, I've only ever had a couple, but I think the couple I have had, I've done pretty well in them. But
like, I've always done interviews pretty much one-to-one as well. I don't think I've ever had to sit in front of like a board.
Yeah.
And in those cases, it's sort of like, I think if you can get chatting to the person a bit before, like, it's not just like, prove yourself to me, then I think you can do a little bit better.
You can do okay, yeah.
But sometimes people are just like coming in to ask you, like, answer this question.
Yeah. Okay.
Help me.
I get it. Yeah. No, I think we had interviews during the week. They went quite well. I nearly have a week off work, which I can't wait for.
Currently?
I've this week to go.
Okay.
So I'm back tomorrow, right through the weekend, and that's me for a week.
Brilliant.
I can't wait. That's really looking forward to it. Just a nice wee staycation. Gathering myself.
I have next Friday off, and I'm pumped about that.
Oh, do you? Yeah. Very nice. I mean, what are you going to do?
Nothing.
Good. I'm also off next Friday. There you go.
There you go.
I have planned to go and see Once Upon a Time over the weekend.
Yes.
I didn't. No. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I have yet to see the film. But I did watch last night, quite randomly, the SpongeBob SquarePants movie, which is practically the same thing.
Pretty much, yeah. It's as good as.
It's a fucking great movie, though. Yeah. Like, it's so funny. And I had a vegan pizza.
Okay.
That's what I had.
You had a vegan pizza before. I think you talked about this before.
I actually had one out of Apache.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is it good?
It's very good.
Huh.
It's very good indeed, yeah. So I had that last night, something to eat. I got my haircut during the week up with the main man. We had some solid discussion on podcasts, on conspiracies, on aliens, everything you need to pass the time while you get your hair cut.
You know.
So that was great. And I got caught in a storm while out on a run this week.
Oh, did you? Yeah. Oh, was that on?
Yes.
Wednesday.
Yes.
Evening? Yeah.
Right in the middle of the week. It was. Yeah. I got absolutely drenched.
It was a torrential.
Oh, it was absolutely
rainfall.
Brutal.
Yeah.
But yeah,
was that like late in the evening?
So I came home from work. It would have been about 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
six o'clock, maybe around that.
Yeah, I was in traffic when that happened, and I was just brutal. Like, "Is this the end of the world?"
When I went out, it was okay. It was just a little bit like kind of windy, and I thought it could rain, but it won't be too bad. And I got my second lap in, and the heavens just opened, and I thought, well, I'm here now.
It's one of those circumstances where it's like, I'm already wet.
I'm already wet.
I'm not going to get home without getting wet, so you might as well just.
Thankfully, my phone is waterproof. and my headphones have appeared to be waterproof, so I'm happy enough with that.
Proved to be waterproof.
But yeah, that was a very uneventful week from we last spoke.
Aye. I mean, I think mine's been the same.
Yeah.
You know, it's only been a couple of days. We got a dishwasher.
How's that?
Got a dishwasher. I will eat my words here, Chris. I remember saying whenever we were looking for houses, it was like, oh, a dishwasher is something that's nice to have, but by no means it's
necessary. Yeah.
Right? And I'm like, we're not gonna strive out.
Yeah.
Yeah. After having had to wash dishes for like the last couple months, getting a dishwasher has made me realize that it is way more of a benefit than you ever anticipated it to be. It's like, it's not essential, no, but you definitely underestimate the benefit you have. I mean,
so you just load that bad boy up over a day or two, and then away we go.
And then you wash, and then everything's just ready. You don't have to wash it. You don't have to wash everything down. And then rinse everything down.
What made you in the first place want to get a dishwasher? Or was it just something that was just like...
The place we're in doesn't have a dishwasher, right? Okay. So it was like, okay. My understanding of that was you cannot get a dishwasher.
Yeah.
If a house isn't plumbed
to hold one. Yeah.
A dishwasher. And the dishes piled up one weekend and I was like, I have to wash all these now. Because generally speaking, Laura cooks and I just do the dishes afterwards. Yeah. And I was slacking a bit, Chris.
Okay, yeah. I get it.
I was like, God almighty, I have to wash all these. This is going to take me like, it takes me forever to wash the dishes. I don't know about you.
Do you want
to
do it right? Like, you got to.
You know, I do. And I'm picky.
Yeah.
Like, whenever I wash the dishes, when I put them in the drawer, I'm investigating them. And if they're not completely clean,
they're going back in. And they're not just going back in for a quick, they're going back in for the full rub down.
Yeah, 100%, exactly. Yeah. So it's like, it sucks doing that.
Yeah, I get it.
So the way I wash dishes is I'll get everything into the sink and then I'll sort of like, I'll rinse them quickly, soap them up, and then I'll wash them individually with like a scrubber, set them up on the draining board, get everything scrubbed, and then I'll take it back in the sink and I'll rinse everything, and then I'll set them into the drying rack.
Yeah,
and then whenever they're dry, then I'll put them in the cupboard, and that takes fucking ages.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah,
and it just annoyed me, right? And I was like, I have to do this. This is going to take me a good 45 minutes, like legitimately 45 minutes to wash these dishes sitting here. It's like, I don't want to do this. So I looked up: is it possible to get like a miniature portable dishwasher? Mm-hmm. And it kind of is.
Okay.
You can get like tabletop ones. That's the one we got. So it says six plate settings. So like six bowls, six plates, 12 six cups. Right.
Knives and forks things again.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Which is more than enough for our needs. But you do got to plumb it in some way.
Okay.
There are ways of doing it. So you can like hook it up to the kitchen sink tap.
Okay.
We couldn't wind up doing that, but I was like, fuck it. I'll do the extra bit of plumbing and like get the wee like Y adapter so I can like hook it up beside the washing machine. So everything's just, that's fine. Mm-hmm. Did that there. Did the first wash. And I was like, can I literally just put these straight into the drawer?
Yeah.
How boring are our lives that I'm talking about this?
No. Dude, this is a big moment in your life.
I was so like, excited.
This is great.
Like, I can put these things in. I don't got to check to make sure they're perfectly washed.
No, you know. Yeah, you trust. Yeah, absolutely. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So that was the
event. That's fantastic.
That was the highlight of my week.
Good. I'm delighted for you.
No, but that's just something people out there, like, get a dishwasher. I don't even care if you're one of those people that's like, no, I don't mind washing the dishes. I like getting my hands good and, you know, clean in the soapy water.
Yeah.
You're saving yourself some time.
Yeah.
Whatever the cost is.
Get a dishwasher.
I'm all about saving time at all costs.
What make is your dishwasher?
It's Curry's.
Curry's?
Essentials.
Okay, brand. There you go.
It's cheap.
There you
go. It's not
Go to Curry's and get the Essentials dishwasher.
I did that. We also got a KFC during the week.
How was that?
I hadn't had a KFC in a while.
What'd you get?
Got the like a boneless banquet, but like for two people. It's like a boneless bucket or something like
that. Oh, okay.
It was lovely, actually. It's very tasty.
Nice.
Then we also got a Five Guys as well.
Oh, where from?
Five Guys.
Yeah, but Belfast?
Yeah, Belfast,
How was that?
Delectable.
It's so good.
They're such good.
Yeah.
Such good products, Chris.
The fries are so good. You don't mind paying the extra, do you?
No.
Because you know it's a fucking good quality burger.
Regular fries and it was like...
Oh, the regular
fries. I could eat for days.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was very, very tasty.
Excellent.
We were getting a lot of takeout because I had refused to wash the dishes until we got this dishwasher installed. So
it was
It was a couple of days of takeout.
I get it.
To bridge that gap. What else? Oh yeah, just yesterday, I set up the PlayStation again to go back into Spider-Man because I have to go finish that game. I never did. Did you? You've got Spider-Man?
I do.
Yeah, did you ever finish it?
Absolutely not, no.
I've decided I have to do it now.
Too many things got in the way and I just put it to one side.
This is it. I mean, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
But too many parts of it made me go like, oh, I just can't be bothered playing this.
Yeah.
So part of that was the combat. Another part of it was ever having to play as not Spider-Man, by which I mean fucking Mary Jane and Miles Morales. Yeah. I just don't
care for that.
I like the characters. I just don't care for those segments at all.
I get it.
Literally last night, that's when I stopped playing a game, was ever they made me do another one of those missions. So I was just like,
I'll leave it. Turn that off. Day. Yeah.
But yeah, that's what I've been up to.
It's fantastic. I got yesterday I went to Monaghan and I got during my travels, I got a watermelon granita.
Granita?
Yeah, it's like a frozen, it's like a watermelon slushy.
Okay.
Very good.
Oh.
Very tasty.
Very interesting.
My sister got a lemonade. An old-fashioned lemonade.
Where do you get this?
Do you know in the Monaghan Shopping Centre?
In the middle?
The Insomnia Coffee Bar there?
Yeah.
They had like these like seasonal drinks. So I was like, yeah, let's get one of these.
Fair play.
It was very tasty.
Fair play.
But yeah. That's so boring. I know it's been so boring.
There's not been much to do.
Not been much. No. Hopefully by the next podcast we'll have racked up a lot of interesting tidbits. Yeah, definitely. I'm happy enough for that. If you're happy. Yeah?
Yeah.
Sorry that it was such a boring week for us. But plenty to think about with our two fantastic feats this week. We'll be back next week with another...
Yeah, right enough.
I don't... Any ideas on what you want to do next week?
No. I think we'll...
Should you have seen Once Upon a Time? I don't want to say for sure I will have.
I want to go to the cinema tonight for sure, but I don't think we'll be seeing it.
Will you see Spider-Man instead?
Either Spider-Man or The Lion King, I think. Is it? I still want to see Toy Story if it's in there.
Yeah, it's still there.
Yeah.
Are you going in Belfast?
Yeah, it'll be in Belfast.
Okay, yeah.
So hopefully get to see think about it. Do you know what's actually coming up soon is QCon?
Yep.
Actually, so
next Friday, Saturday. Next Friday, yeah. Next Friday,
so it could be QCon.
Exactly, could be QCon pod. Yeah, QPod.
Could do it up there.
Right now, if we could get Sinker back in. Yeah. Jesus, it's been a while.
We could do it up there.
We could do it up there, yeah. Just take up the equipment.
Mixers
and
mics.
Yep.
We could do it up there.
100%.
Some night.
Fantastic,
sure.
That's a great idea.
Okay.
Okay, there we go. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, it's been episode 85 of the podcast. Once again, thank you to everybody who's tuned in. If this has been your first podcast, we hope you enjoyed it. Please look back through our other podcasts. Have a listen. I'm sure you'll find something that tickles your fancy. We do cover a whole host of topics and such wide varieties that there's bound to be something, at least one episode for 10 minutes that would appeal to you.
All of the advice says focus on a niche.
Yeah.
Nail down the market. We've avoided that entirely. We've went as broad as the spectrum can possibly allow. Yeah,
exactly. So
you'll find something you enjoy.
Yeah. You can find all of the audio versions, so you can take us with you on the go, no matter where you are. On any podcast hosting service. We just made it that easy for you. Or you can find the video version if you want to see me and Dee sitting around our table in our studio. You will find that over at youtube.com/xitegaming. That's XITE gaming. And find us there. Leave us a comment because we'd love to hear from you. And then we will discuss the comments
That was
in the previous
the
podcast.
Other thing I had to mention.
Or questions.
Questions. Talking about leaving a comment, if you want to know what that feels like, here's a little story I have for you, Chris.
Yeah, I'm listening.
About a year ago,
mm-hmm.
I wrote a little message to a popular podcast that I listen to frequently.
Right,
you might listen to it too. It's called It's Obvious Gaming.
Oh yes.
We listen to them a lot. Mm-hmm. I wrote them a message like a year ago.
Was this for like one of their questions, like an ask?
Just for a question. I actually forgot about writing it, but I asked them something along the lines of, what is your food of choice after a night of drinking?
Yes.
Like a hangover?
Yes, like yes, yes.
And I just listened to their podcast yesterday.
Did they get back? Did they use it? Oh, I need to listen
after
to it.
After about a year and a half.
I will listen to that podcast today when I'm running.
I heard my handle come up. It's like, this nice question is from Mongoose. And I was like, hey, that's me.
Nice. Excellent.
So that little feeling I had was just of a random happiness.
Yeah.
For no other reason.
Exactly.
So strangers on the internet read out my question. So if you want that.
Random happiness. Yeah, exactly. We can provide that. All you have to do is just provide us with a question, a comment, a thought, anything. We will read it. The more we have to discuss, the better our podcast will be. It fuels the latter half of this podcast tremendously.
Stops it from just, sort of
snowballing, tangenting.
Just falling down.
We do like a good tangent though.
No, we do.
I do like a good
Speaking
tangent.
Speaking of.
Mm-hmm. So thank you for that. If you're tuning in, please do leave us a comment, leave us a question, leave us anything. But apart from that, we'll see you all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed next week for episode 86 of the Empty Promise Podcast. Good night and God bless.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Do, 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 do. Oh. Oh. Do, 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 oh.